warming it up, clearing out the cornbread.
Do, re, mi, fa, so, cornbread dough.
Cornbread dough.
That cornbread dough. Hello, and welcome to Grapes and Grain Podcast. I'm Teeny.
And I'm Laura. And this podcast is about our favorite thing in the whole world.
Alcoholic beverages. So today we're going to explore some questions that may sound easy to answer, but they're actually quite complicated.
So we're going to explore what constitutes a good beer and a good wine, and why people are so damn passionate about it.
Like, so damn passionate. Like, why are people like us dedicating their careers to it? But
like, leaving careers, shifting life.
All for a glass of bubbly or still.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of which, before we get started, Laura, can I ask you, what you drinking?
What you drinking?
Yeah, I would love to answer that for you. So since we're talking today about what makes us so passionate about it, I think what really roots it down in where it all started. And for me, one of the coming out of my early 20s, drinking a lot of liquor and a lot of beer, you know, had all those digestive problems, which my doctor suggested I don't drink beer anymore and switch to wine. And so one of the first things I explored in with some industry professionals was a Malbec. So I brought a Malbec today.
Ooh, it's, love a Malbec.
You know, it's one of those like good, very approachable reds that gets a lot of young people, I feel, of our generation into wine.
And I love wine from Spanish-speaking countries because I'm partial to the Spanish language.
Yeah. So true. Because you majored in Spanish, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. So the Valle Secreto from the Rhonell Valley is from Chile. It's 2014. It has a really dark and beautiful color. And one of my favorite tasting notes about it is that it has woodland flavors, which I don't know what that means, but it's very like, I don't know, green and herbaceous and hearty and lively.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I think of like South Park woodland critter creatures.
Yeah, yes. That's exactly what I'm tasting. That's so on the nose. Well, Teeny, can you tell me what you drinking?
What you drinking?
Yeah, so I actually went the opposite way, I thought, because since today we're going to talk about quality, maybe I should spotlight one of the most reputable brands in Texas, and that is St. Arnold Brewing Company. Yeah. Not only are they one of the oldest breweries in Texas, celebrating 24 years in 2018, they're also one of the most esteemed. So sure, they were here first, but they're also doing it right. And in 2017 at the Great American Beer Festival, they won mid-sized brewery of the year, I want to say. Mm. And so that means across the country, they were honored as the number one brewery in that size category.
Nice.
So what I brought today was a St. Arnold. This is their 5 o'clock Pilsner. It's got Saaz hops in it, and it's basically really light, really easy drinking. The unique thing about Pilsners is it's a lager instead of an ale, which we talked about last time. And it's really hard to do right. So I figured if we're talking about quality, I wanted to showcase one of the best breweries in town and showcase a style that they do incredibly well.
Cool. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
So as we touched on earlier just a moment ago, today we're talking about what constitutes the quality of a good beer and wine.
Yeah. So, but what does quality exactly mean? So we can use this term to say this is quality, that's quality. But what is inherently quality about beer and wine? I can start, you know, for beer, the number one thing is going to be ingredients, right? Mm. So the whole craft movement was really born out of trying to innovate on a bland product that supposedly used cheap ingredients and adjuncts. And when I say adjuncts, that refers to things like wheat, corn, rice that affect the texture of the beer rather than the flavor of the beer. And back in the day, you know, corn, rice, these things were product of necessary means. That's what the United States had to make beer with. But in more recent times, the perception is now that big brewers use these things to cut corners and not only cut costs. So I once worked on a story about how once brewers are done making beer, they give their spent grain to local farmers in the area.
Oh, yeah. What do they do? Like, they can't replant that.
No, they don't replant it. They use it to feed their cattle.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
What a luxury life for
it is.
Cattle.
And I mean, it's a great business thing because it doesn't cost either party anything. Yeah. But this farmer I spoke with really is testament to this whole quality and craft thing, because what he said is brewers are generally so picky about the grains that they use that he
is able to advertise an all-natural beef product because the cows are ingesting very few, if any, pesticides because of the quality of the grain.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, so these cows are getting, like, organic and non-GMO-y type category quality of grains.
Exactly.
Wow.
So I think that's where it starts, at least in terms of beer.
Cool. Well, I would say for wine, the fruit quality is definitely off the bat most people's knee-jerk reaction to say what makes a good wine good or a great wine great. But I was talking to Aaron Benson. He's the manager over at Veritas, and I'll introduce him a little later in one of our interviews. But he was talking not just the grape itself, but the combination of the grape and where it's grown. You have some powerhouse duos across the world. And so if you think about in Bordeaux, like left bank with the Gravel and the Cabernet Sauvignon, and the right bank with the clay and the Merlot, or like in Champagne, the limestone and the high acidity. That's why these places are actually so renowned. And they've also been making wine for hundreds of years.
So yeah, so it's not just their reputation, it's also the quality of what they're doing?
Absolutely. It's a trial and error that they've already like worked through. It's the experience. It's proven through centuries what tastes the best in these weird little pockets. So.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting that you mentioned those regions because, you know, as we have talked about, American wine is really holding its own now. Mm. But I am interested because my boss recently did this thing with an Instant Pot. She made wine out of Welch's grape juice, red wine yeast, and in an Instant Pot. And like, I tried.
Instant Pots do everything.
I know, right? And I tried it.
Did you?
Okay, this is what happened. It smells like a juice box.
Yes.
And then you taste it, and it was so alcoholic. It was super hot.
Oh, I'm sure there's
so much. Super long legs.
Sugar in there to begin
with. But it was dry, exactly like a red wine. It was kind of a mind fuck, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So, like, how is that possible? How are you able to make wine out of grapefruit juice? And, like, where do those grapes come from, and does that matter?
Yeah, totally. So, as we talked about last week, and we'll approach in our next episode.
In the next episode.
So when you get alcohol, basically what's happening is a basic process called fermentation. That is the process, chemical change of sugar changing into alcohol, and usually yeast and temperature is the catalyst of that.
The yeast eat the sugar and they fart out alcohol.
Yeah.
It's called fermentation.
It's scientifically accurate.
For third graders.
So if you think about it just in the broad sense of fermentation, yes, anything that has sugar that gets a bacteria or a yeast in it that will convert it into something else, like alcohol, yes, that is chemically possible to create Welch's grapefruit wine. But the major difference in, like, what we get in the Welch's grape juice or what we're eating off of a bunch of grapes and what we're drinking in a wine glass is that there are two different styles of grapes, like different classes of grapes. So in table grapes and in Welch's, it's Concord. You remember that from the TV commercials when we were kids, the Concord grapes. Real Concord grapes. But in wine, it's a class of grapes called Vitis vinifera, which is where your Cabernet Sauvignons, your Chardonnays, all of those are. So it's typically thicker skins, higher tannins in the skins, less sugar, less pulp. You know, it's less desirable to eat off the vine, but more desirable.
Have you ever, like, eaten any just off the vine?
You know, I did get to do that. This last summer, when I went to a bachelorette party in Temecula, I flew into Sacramento, drove myself down the coast, stopped in Napa, looked at some graduate schools, and yes, at UC Davis and at Trefethen Winery in Napa, I got to just roam the little student and petting vineyards and pluck different. I happened to go right before harvest, so everything was ripe and
super juicy.
Yeah, it was perfect. And also, coincidentally, it was 2 weeks before the fires broke out in Napa, which was really
good
terrible
timing
and
on
crazy.
Your part.
Yeah, and really fortunate I was able
so
to be there.
So, what do they taste like?
So they are, gosh, some of them are really acidic, some of them are really sweet, but really the major difference is the skin is not tender at all. It's like a thick, chewy, like almost like leathery, it's like skin.
Ooh.
You know?
Yeah. You have to like pierce it.
Imparts a lot of the qualities in red wine when you create it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Ingredients are super important. Like you said, grapes are the backbone of wine. Grain is the backbone of beer. But you could have the best ingredients in the world and still make a not great beer. So what really determines the quality beyond the ingredients is a brewer's skill. And what a brewer is going for with any style is balance. Mm. So that's largely defined by a couple of things, such as aroma, appearance, flavor, and mouthfeel. And in fact, those are even the categories used to judge beer competitions, too. Those are the subcategories.
The metrics.
Exactly. The rubrics in which. Yeah, you get, you know, however many out of 10 points for each different thing. Mm. But even though you're going for those things and you're going for balance, that's not to, like, limit experimentation. One of the big complaints about the beer judging certification program is that it does define styles. And yeah. So even if you make a good beer, but it's not to style, you're going to be like punished for that.
Yeah.
But the cool thing about it is that like craft brewers don't really care anymore.
Oh, they're so going rogue.
Yeah, you can use a base style and you can experiment from there, add your own personality. Yeah. So you can make like a crazy grapefruit IPA, but you pour it in a glass and it's full of sediment or like floating hot particles like the one I brewed earlier this year was.
Yeah, I remember that. It was like, enjoy that glass, just pour it really carefully, stop there.
Yeah, stop there. And then it was still like, it was way overcarbonated and so the sediment was swirling everywhere.
Totally.
You know, all of those are going to have an adverse effect on the overall drinking experience, which is what you're really going for in a quality beer.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, one of my interviews spoke to that. It's less about the actual thing and your experience with it.
Correct.
I love that. Well, that's definitely relatable to wine, too. So definitely, yes, the quality of the grape and how it's grown and handled while it's harvested super matters. But winemakers also make a substantial contribution to that process.
I mean, that's why they call it a craft or an art.
Yes, yes. So when a winemaker first approaches a wine, so you harvest it, you crush it, you have this juice, do you keep it on the skins, do you not?
Do people still crush it with their toes, or is that just novelty?
I think it's a touch novelty. There's some traditional places, and gosh, don't quote me on this, it'd be more like probably like Eastern Europe and maybe historic parts of Italy, but and I did it once in Lubbock.
Historic Lubbock.
Yeah, historic and
renowned
beautiful
wine country
from the Renaissance. But I mean, it happens, but I think it is a little bit more for novelty,
mm-hmm.
just because it's not practical for the time and energy and feeder
growth. We have machines.
You have a thing. Yeah,
there was an episode of The Bachelor, and this is totally off topic, but there was an episode of The Bachelorette where the bachelorette and the guy she took on the date go to Napa and they stomp grapes and make wine, and they literally take a glass, fill it up with the foot stuff. It's chunky. It's not filtered. And they drank it. This is true.
I don't not believe you, but I don't like it.
Is that bullshit?
No. Oh my gosh. So, winemaking matters. So, like, yes, the skins, how long do you keep it on? How, like, right off the bat, do you sell the wine as soon as it's fermented? Or in certain styles of, like, Barolo and Montepulciano, do you age it for a certain time? Or, like, Rioja? And that really is a defining characteristic of the quality of that varietal or style. And then the winemaker's also going for something called structure. There was a wine we had together at a dinner with, I think it was like Evelyn. And I just remembered this thing that poked out to me at this dinner. It was one of the first time I had a wine that I could actually describe as flat. It was like flabby. There was just jammy and round and just flat all around.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Flat all around.
Nailed
it.
Yeah. So winemakers are trying to create structure, and there's different elements you can use to do that, like acids and tannins and how it balances with the sugars. And that's what makes a really quality wine in the making, is that it's balanced. It hits each of those qualities, but unless you're doing something rogue, like a in-your-face Cab or Syrah, mm-hmm. specific to its
That's really its interesting.
Own kin. Yeah.
So the thing that strikes me about wine is sort of the price.
Mm.
Is it true that the more expensive the wine, the higher the quality?
Okay, so no. But also, yes. No in the sense that you can get some amazing values for the actual wine that you're getting. Like the Spanish wines we mentioned earlier, you lived in Spain for a little bit. You know that you can get some good wine there for a reasonable price. And in Italy, too, like price is not necessarily like, indicative of the quality. But if you are looking at higher end wine and why it some of them get expensive. It's not just marketing. So it could be a factor of the rarity of the fruit or like these amazing world-renowned locations. Some of them are really small. So there's a pretty limited amount of product that actually comes from there. And there's a high demand. So that will drive price.
Supply and demand.
Yeah.
It rules everything.
It's life. That's life. So, but then you actually look at the specific kind of harvests. You know, we were reading up on midnight harvests and hand picking. And so if, say, in like Mosel, Germany, it's extremely steep slopes and you can't just use like a conventional tractor to get out there or like a mechanical harvester.
Sure.
It's, you know, expensive equipment. It's hand picking in these places. So just the sheer labor that goes into it can drive price as well. And then the aging. So not only you're paying for space to keep it and space to age it, but the wood itself, you can reuse old wood. But if you're looking to impart a lot of really spicy characters into your red wines, you need new oak. And when you look at certain styles of oak, French oak is a lot more expensive than American oak. And then if you get into French oak, you can get into the specific forest where it's coming from and like the weave and the tightness of the actual wood grain, which like controls how much oxidation is happening. And then you're getting into like over $1,000, $2,000 per barrel. And you use that once, 5, 10 times maybe, and then you move on to the next thing. So that is pretty significant factor in driving cost as well.
I can only imagine if I spent $2,000 on one piece of equipment, I would expect to have it a lifetime, not just 5 years.
Get a lot of life out of it. Well, I guess you could just use it for like some sort of spirit or something after that.
Yeah, you could.
So, yeah, I don't know. There is definitely some reputation and marketing involved, but a lot of other qualities. So it's not all snobbery, but what about beer snobbery? Is that a thing?
Ha!
Yeah.
Yeah. Beer snobbery is totally a thing. I know that winos are the ones that apparently have their nose turned up to everything, but beer snobbery is totally a thing.
Yeah.
You know, and especially beer collecting, too. Wine collecting is something that is a lot of times associated with wine, you know, wine cellars. I have spoken to several collectors who have hundreds and hundreds of bottles stowed away, much like I assume a wine collector would. And they're the type of people who they go to a brewery, they camp out for hours. It's terrible weather. They drove 12 hours just to be there, just to make sure that they have this one bottle of beer that's only going to be released or only produced once in their lifetime. You know, it's kind of crazy.
It kind of. That's like super crazy. That's like a super fans of... I mean, people did that for Star Wars.
I know, and that's not even a tangible thing.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about price, like, price can be related to certain quality factors, such as, you know, how it's made or how long it was aged. But most of the time, it's related to rarity. And in fact, there's an entire black market for beers on the internet that you dive down that for 5 minutes and you're like, whoa, this is an insane, like the passion part of this is so evident. People are like really trying to capitalize on that.
Oh.
So today I was going to...
Dark underbelly.
Exactly. No, it really is, because today I was going to bring a beer to drink called Elements of Composition, which is a collaboration between Jester King Brewery in Austin, Degarde in Oregon, and then Sante Adarius in California. And all of these breweries use spontaneous fermentation to create their beers.
Ooh,
so
what does that mean? I like the sound of it.
Yeah, so instead of like pitching yeast in a controlled environment, what they do is brew a batch of beer, as it's called, wort at the time, and they just leave the windows open. So they let
the
natural
saran wrap over the top or anything.
No, they let the natural yeast and bacteria from the air and the local environment.
It's risky.
It is risky, but that's what makes these breweries so special. So Jester King is actually like on the outskirts of Austin in the Hill Country. And so Degarde and Sante Adarius both do this. And that's what makes them so special. So this one beer is they brewed the same beer and then let it spontaneously ferment in 3 different parts of the country.
Cool.
And then they blended it together, right?
Oh, that's so neat.
So, a super special beer. I happened to be at Jester King for an unrelated circumstance when the release was happening. And
awesome. So where's our beer?
Well, hundreds of people were lined up. And I was there to interview the founder, who you'll hear in a minute. But hundreds of people were lined up. And then when the line was finally like 20 deep, we were like, sure, let's go get in line. They ran out a couple people ahead of us. So I didn't get it. They were selling for $28 a bottle then. And I just looked online today, $260 a piece. $260 a piece for the exact same bottle.
How many ounces is it?
It's 750 milliliters.
Oh.
So that just goes to the whole price thing. Yeah. Price inflation is definitely based in the beer world, primarily, I would say, on how readily available the beer is actually, not necessarily the quality. That's a super quality beer, don't get me wrong, but they were selling it for $28 a bottle themselves.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's so interesting that I did not realize people were collecting beer in that way, actually, until you did that story when I read that, and I thought that was really interesting. And, you know, in the world of wine collecting, too, one of the gals I interviewed for a little later named Juhi, who is I think a pretty avid wine collector, but she called herself an amateur wine collector and mentioned several times because once you fall down even that rabbit hole of wine collection, you know, you're talking about estate cellars with thousands of bottles and like interest pieces, and which was where counterfeiting a lot of wine gets into. People like the third Koch brother that you never hear about. Or is it Koch brother?
Koch.
Oh, sorry.
But he is
Freudian
a Koch.
Slip.
He is a Koch counterfeiter.
Time. But yeah, so she has about 400 bottles, and it was the same.
Whoa, I would consider that a collector.
Right? I thought so, too.
I have exactly one unopened bottle at my house and three in the recycle bin.
That's I am actually sitting on four wine bottles right now that I've been holding for about a year, and I feel extraordinarily adult and accomplished about it.
Hey, I have a question.
Yeah.
So keeping beer in a bottle, how long is it? Does it stay good?
Yeah.
This is a great question. It does. It really depends on the style. So IPAs, India Pale Ales, are really popular right now because they are super hoppy and bitter up forward or like juicy, but their hop character is what defines them.
Right.
Hops disintegrate over time, and then the flavor diminishes over time. So if you want the best of that IPA, you best drink it off the tank or as soon as
sure.
you get
like
it.
Plenty of the Elder and those ones.
Exactly. Those are not the types of beer you want to age, but things like sour beers or stouts.
Stouts, yeah.
Especially ones that are maybe even bourbon barrel aged or any sort of barrel aged. Those like appreciate with time. So not only does it get a little boozier, the alcoholic flavor sort of burns off and mellows out. You'll get, you know, a lot of leverage out of a sour beer after many years because the yeast is still active in there.
Mm.
And so it'll continue to eat the sugar and make it more alcoholic as well.
Well, that's so interesting, too, because that's kind of the case with wine. They say you're not really, like, 90 to 95% of wines aren't meant to be aged. They're meant to be drink fresh. And even wines like champagne.
That's really interesting, because vintage is all the rage.
I know. You always, like, blah, 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 Bordeaux, blah. I mean, but those, like, yeah.
But, yeah. That was exactly what they said.
Me. So, no, for sure, there are some, like, we went to a friend's child's christening baptism, and their parents opened a 1999 bottle of Bordeaux, and I mean that was good. Some of those are like those Italian wines that are extremely astringent and acidic and tannin
mellow
heavy.
Out over time.
Yeah. So those can really do great, but you know, Pinot Noir, Merlot, you know, drink them.
Like and their flavor profile is the best when they're fresher.
Totally, but there are certain things like champagnes. If there's a vintage champagne, people will keep it for the novelty, I believe. And in my humble opinion, they'll keep it for the novelty and have it like 50, 100 years later. But it's gross. It's brown. It's oxidized. It doesn't taste like champagne anymore. It has like weird nutty, caramely things instead of like, you know, fresh biscuity or like apples. And it's because it's been oxidized so much, but you appreciate what it is because it's a fancy fucking bottle of 100-year-old champagne.
Yeah, you know? But I mean, by that thing, you could just keep the bottle, right?
I don't
like,
know.
Like, why would you even open it after that long?
Well, that's what they're selling some, like, Thomas Jefferson reds, and they're like, it's going to be vinegar. It's just really just a conversation piece at that point, if it's even not counterfeit.
Yeah. Fun fact, I met Christy Brinkley at the Tom Thumb in Southlake, Texas, during the launch of her Prosecco, and I have exactly one bottle. It's empty, unfortunately, but it's signed by her, so if any Christy Brinkley fans are out there willing to pay me, I'll sell it like a 100-year-old bottle of champagne.
You know, I think I drank that Prosecco with you, and it was actually pretty decent. It's all like organic or biodynamic or something. It's kind of expensive for a Prosecco. But
yeah,
it
like
was
$16.99 or something.
Ooh, I feel like it was like $20.25.
I'm not going to admit this on air, but I'm about to. I accidentally walked out of the store and I got them for free.
Oh, no.
I
was so starstruck getting my bottle signed.
I was like, signature. You get the photo. It's. I just walked out of the Tom Thumb. I felt so bad. I felt so bad. That is totally against my nature. While we're talking about questionable decisions, let's read you a word from our sponsor, Boss Wine. Boss Wine. It's shitty, but if you're drunk, do you even know the difference?
Boss Wine is made from real Welch's Concord grape juice. Just add a little yeast and throw it in your Instapot. And before you know it, you too can be drinking your worries away.
It's shitty wine, but if you're drunk, do you even know the difference? Buy some, except you gotta make it.
Yeah.
Boss Wine.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you are a retailer or a producer and would like to sponsor us or have your product featured in our What You Drinkin' segment, drop us an email at grapesingrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
Cheers. And we're back. So the second half of this episode is dedicated to the passion aspect of beer and wine. Why is it such a passion point, booze? Besides, booze. You know, the fact that we may be mildly addicted.
Speak for yourself, okay. Mildly.
Okay, so why is beer such a passion point? You know, from when... This is going to depend on who you ask. But for me, it was sort of just falling down. In all seriousness, the more I started to learn about beer, the more that I realized how much there is to learn. And I'm sort of an education junkie. That's just like my nature as a journalist. But I've interviewed several people on the subject, and I've gotten a wide array of answers to this question. What about you?
Oh, totally. I'm super passionate about wine, and in interviewing each of these separate people, I thought what was so striking is it is different for every person, what really brings them every day to the table, and it really is just so in aligned with their personalities. And one of the answers that really stuck out to me was from my collector, Juhi Williamson, and she does not work in the wine industry at all. She never has. She comes from a music background, and she's a tax professional now, but she was one I mentioned that has 400 just shy of 400 bottles of wine. She has 3 floor-to-ceiling cases, and I came over to her home to do some yoga, and she was doing an inventory there everywhere. It was crazy, but she...
Sounds like heaven.
Yeah, I was like... So she is really one of the people that I would credit to pushing my wine education journey to the next level, but she totally nerds out on the aspect of... analyzing and tasting and categorizing wine. So here's a clip about what she had to say about that.
When I think back and see when I would say certain wine is good, and I think it's when the wine really gives you the urge to describe it, right? You stop and start describing the wine and, you know, oh, nose of plum, black currant, or hint of tobacco with a long finish, you know, like you just decide to describe it. And I think that's what is good wine. But, you know, we started, you know, with the description like, oh, that wine was good, or wine was fantastic. Or then, you know, slowly we get a little matured, and we will say that, oh, we taste black raspberry jam, or bitter chocolate, or, you know, violets. You know? Then you start buying stuff, right? You buy the decanters and see if that makes any differences, sommelier glasses, large wine fridges, and that type of thing. So that once I kind of started, you know, that journey and sharing the enthusiasm about wine, I just came to make friends with the people with the same interest and enthusiasm. So, you know, for example, Alice is my best friend, and she's one who really moved my level of enthusiasm to a different paradigm. And we started kind of bi-weekly blind wine tasting, and there were 4 of us. So among 4 of us, so each will bring a bottle of wine. Yeah. And then we had wine reference books ready on the table and had a laptop on standby. And along with the guesses, right, what wine this would be, we start with the old versus new, varietal, and the vintage. It was a lot of fun. Then bottle is revealed, right? Then then we open the encyclopedia and go to the tasting, like compare that with our tasting notes and learn about the region and learn about the varietal and winemaker and, you know, kind of share each other's tasting notes. It was just so a lot of fun. But then what makes a great wine, to me, it's about the pairing. So pairing with the food, pairing with occasions, or the most important thing is pairing with the good friends, who you're with, who you're sharing the notes with, you know, that makes a great wine in my opinion.
Yeah, awesome. I mean, that makes total sense. Who I talked to first was Jeffrey Stuffings, who is the founder and brewer at Jester King Brewery in Austin, Hills Country, who I mentioned earlier. And when I was preparing for this podcast, I just thought that I would run the question by him. In my mind, you know, I had some preconceived notions about what it means to me, but then he answered with something completely unexpected. And you'll hear him in the clip. He admits his answer to this question has evolved over time, but for him right now, it's something I think a lot of people in the digital age can connect to. So I'll let him tell you about it.
To me, you know, my kind of feelings on this have evolved over the years, and where I'd say they are at now is that, you know, we live in a very, you know, distracted world where, you know, people, you know, have a million things going on, and especially beer, because I think it's such a great social beverage. Like, it provides an opportunity for people just to, like, sit down and just have, like, face-to-face human interaction, yeah. which is, you know, it'd be hard to come by in, like I said, a distracted world. So, you know, I think, beer, wine, spirits is a great conduit for that, you know, for actually being a human being and you know, just getting to hang out with, you know, friends and family.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of why I love alcohol. It's kind of yes, it's delicious, and yes, it's fun to, you know, get a little tipsy, but I think it's really just, I think it's the most wonderful thing about it is that, you know, it creates, you know, human interaction, communities, you know, social dynamics. So.
Well, I had a lovely opportunity to speak with Aaron Benson, who I had the pleasure of working with under Front Burner at 60 Vines last year, and he's now managing Veritas Wine Room, which I don't know if you remembered. It opened when we were in college, and Flio's roommate, actually, after they opened, got a tattoo that says Veritas across his ribs.
Where is it? Is it in Dallas?
It is. It's right by the Knox Henderson area, right next to that place, Eberhard, that you just wrote the article about recently. Uh-huh. But yeah, it's tucked away right in the strip, and it is a great little spot. They have amazing deals and a really interesting wine list. And it seems like the perfect place where he would have ended up. What he had to talk about, his passion point, began as a child and his love for traveling and culture and people. So here's what he had to say about that.
I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I think that I can trace back how I ended up here to my grandfather and my grandmother, who were avid travelers. And I think that that sort of informed me in finding this career you know, really wanting to do something that would allow me to see the world. I have to say the travel opportunities, which are exactly what I was after, have been big contributors to. I've taken, I think, 18 trips up and down the West Coast. I recently came back from Chile. I've got a France trip planned for a couple of weeks, and I might be going to New Zealand this year as well. I remember, like, deciding before I even knew what kind of career I wanted, I decided that I wanted to be a worldly person. I remember in high school telling people when I grow up I want to be an expatriate. I seem to mean it a little more every year.
Yeah.
I guess I'm not grown up yet, but you know, basically, like, I'm the type of person that if I like something, I just dive fully into it, and I want to know everything, and I want to. You know, if I'm in a conversation about it, I'm not going to open my mouth if anybody there knows more than me and miss the opportunity to learn something, you know.
Great quality.
When I was a kid, it was dinosaurs. Like, I knew everything about dinosaurs. Yeah. And then Twister came out, and I wanted to be a meteorologist, so I studied about weather forever.
Oh, I love it.
I have to dive into things. I want to be, like, an authority on things, so.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of wine, because there is so much. I mean, it's... I think a really admirable quality in people is, and a true sign of wisdom in people is always being aware how much you don't know.
Yes.
And wine is one of those giant rabbit holes that you can dive into. And You know, like things like the barrels, or like, you know, talking about farming methods or pruning methods. You know, there's always something to learn. Everywhere you go, somebody has different insights they can give you, and it's for knowledge hounds. It's a really rewarding career to be in, because it's also sort of, you know, it's there are people who can mentor you. There are groups that you can form that to sort of hold each other accountable, but it really is kind of a solitary pursuit. So it's a personality type, I think. You have to be knowledge hungry. You have to be solitary. You have to really want to broaden your horizons and your experiences. I think that's kind of the foundation of it. But it's also, you know, I think about all the things that I've found interesting at different parts of my life. I mean, paleontology, geology, you know, biology, those things that feed into that, and then weather, climate, and then history. You can bundle all those things up, and if you were to say, here are the five things that are really fascinating to me, there are really only a couple of things that combine all of them, and you know, wine's one of them. So I think that's kind of how I ended up there.
Oh, man, that's actually kind of a perfect segue. The next person I interviewed, her name is Georgina Solis. And until recently, she was one of the only female brewers based in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Really?
So she worked for Pedicles Brewing Company, which made her job as a woman unique because they don't have a lot of mechanized equipment for brewing. So she had to, you know, keep up with the boys in the manual labor of the brewing process and the paddling and the stirring and all of that. She, as of recently, is traveling to Hungary.
Mm-hmm.
To help a brewery over there with their quality analysis and quality control. So she is on to bigger and better things, but I got to know her recently, and you can just tell her passion from the beer comes from the actual making process.
The simplest way I can answer why people are so passionate is because it's hard work, and it's definitely not something you sign up for to just kind of hang out and drink beer, which is a very common misconception. And you hear it a lot as a brewer, as a sales rep, like, oh, you work with beer, your job is so much fun and so easy. It's fun. It's definitely not easy. Whoever said that, I don't know how that saying goes, but it's like the day you find something you love will be the last day you work. That's total BS, because the day you find something you love, you're going to work extra harder. And that's what everybody that I've seen that's been in this industry, they work really, really hard, because that it comes through in the product. It comes through in how you promote it. And if you're just kind of like, well, we'll see how it goes and roll with the punches, people will see that. And so, yeah, the beer, I mean, it drives us to make it the best we can to be able to share that with everybody else. And at least that's why I'm so passionate about it.
That's so cool, and is so relatable to my final interview that I have for you, which is with Jeanette Fitzgerald. I actually had the pleasure of meeting Jeanette through my viticulture and enology classes at Grayson, and she is opening a winery this fall called Fitzel Winery.
Oh, excellent.
Oh, it was super cool. I, 2 weeks ago, got to go and volunteer as part of her planting day, so I got to handle and plant the Riesling and Tempranillo vines. And
literally from the ground up, you've been involved. That's amazing.
I know. I'm so excited, and I'm so excited for her, and I'm so excited for 3 to 5 years from now to be able to taste these wines that we lovingly, I gave each of them a pep talk as I put them in the ground, and it's like, you got this vine, you're going to make the best grapes ever.
And that is so you. You were talking about how this speaks to those people. That speaks exactly to Laura's personality. Yeah. That's amazing.
Oh, so I gave all of her little vines a pep talk, and
thanks, coach.
But it's the same thing. What she had to say about it is it is hard work. And she has already retired and is now, this is her pet post project. And it's a whole family affair. She's bought land out in Gordonville, Texas. She's built, irrigation systems, the driveway, the barns, gotten tractors. She dug each hole. We planted them. She's, her son's going to come out there with a food truck and cater the whole affair. She's going to have family games, because what she had to say about it is, despite all the hard work and switching careers and coming into it, it's all about the experience. It's the mystique and the romance. And what brings you joy when you sit on the countryside with a glass of wine in your hand with your family playing around you in a beautiful space with people you love? It makes all that hard work worth it.
Mm-hmm.
So here's her about Fitzel Winery.
For many, many years, I have loved to go to wineries. I love to go try different wines, sit out on their patios or whatever setup they have, and just enjoy the wine and the experience of being there. And then I did a lot of going to the different wineries and going to the programs and going to the you know, special events all around the country so that you could learn even more and make connections. Because one thing I found in this industry is everybody is so friendly and so happy to help you do things, especially in Texas. It's just, it makes you feel like you're part of a huge family, and if you're stuck, you could pick up the phone and ask anybody, and they would be more than happy to help you. You know, they've been very open. You can come walk around the back, see how we do our winery, take all the pictures you want. It's just been such an open and inviting place. It just makes you feel even better about opening the winery. So it's just something that I love, and I love going and having the experiences. I mean, there is that mystique and the romance about drinking wine in a winery and a vineyard and the caves that the wine was kept in, and then the beautiful vineyards that go on and on and on. And and it is a very romantic setting, and it to me, it makes me feel very calm and happy. And to me, I want an experience where you just feel happy. I mean, there's so many things in life that can make it bumpy, can make it not enjoyable. So to be able to sit down with a glass of wine and have kind of that, even if you know, I'm not sitting in Italy with a vineyard in front of me, it's still in the back of your mind, and it just kind of relaxes me and it makes me happy.
Awesome. So the last person I interviewed, his name is Jace Hicks, and he is one of the local collectors that I was talking about earlier.
Is he one of the ones you featured in your original story?
Yeah, he is. And that story, I asked collectors to take me inside their cellars. And
ooh, how personal.
I know. It really was. I felt, you know, I had to go into these people's homes to build that level of trust. And at the time, he had between about 200 and 300 bottles of beer. Mm. But when I spoke to him recently, he was getting ready to increase that number with a beercation to Denver.
Beercation. I like the sound of that.
Again, this is something that Denver's fanatics do. Yeah. And he said that he went on a work trip. So he's also, as a collector, not in the industry.
Wow.
So he works in tech.
I should get Fleo into that. He's going to work for Denver all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think it's interesting because the collector that you talk to is also not in the industry. So
yeah.
I think it's people with a deep appreciation for the subject that don't necessarily, their lives don't revolve around it professionally, like us. So, you know, he and his fiance are also getting married at a brewery in November.
Oh, which brewery?
Yeah. It's called Great Raft out in Louisiana, in Shreveport.
I love Louisiana.
Yeah. So he, again, is not in the industry, but for him, all roads lead to beer. And one big reason why is community. I'll let him tell you about it.
What gets a lot of people in this industry chasing beers and whatnot is almost, you know, the trading card collecting kind of situation where everybody just wants to collect and hoard. I see that a lot, you know. I started volunteering, then I started meeting, you know, who I people I call my friends, you know, and close friends through the industry. You know, Jules, my fiance, and I, we met through a bottle share. So with getting into craft beer and being passionate, it's definitely, to me, it's a community-driven situation where you just, you know, you meet the people, you melt really well with them, and you know, your excuse to hang out is go to a brewery or, you know, have a bottle share, things of that nature.
Well, gosh, that was so awesome hearing about everyone's perspective on what makes people so damn passionate about
it. I know. It's like all these different reasons, but we all come together over the same thing.
It's so, yeah, it is uniquely community driven.
Yeah, I'll raise a glass to that.
Cheers to that. Thanks so much for joining us on Grapes and Grains. Please look for more episodes soon about the colorful world of beer and wine, and follow us on social media.
And keep listening, because you'll hear more of us just being drunk and stupid.
Yeah. And next episode, we have a really cool guest interview. So
yeah,
be sure to
check
that out.
And shout out to
Ben and Jack and Dorothy Studios.
Yay.
Without them, yeah, it would not be possible.
Without right, whom, our right, corporate sponsorships, and bringing the intelligent questions to the table. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah.
Really appreciate
one
your,
of them.
Everything, yeah. All we right, appreciate you.
Until
cheers,
until next
Ben,
time.
Thanks for coming out.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured in our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com. Absolutely. We love to hear from listeners and share fun stories and answer any random questions we get. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Find us on Instagram at Grapes and Grain Podcasts, underscore between each word, and just search for Grapes and Grain Podcasts on Facebook.
Remember, that's grapes, plural, grain, singular. You can also find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.wordpress.com to see blog posts that go more in-depth to each episode. You can also download or stream our podcast there and find lots of other content about beer and wine.
And of course, find us on patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today.
Cheers!
What you drinking?